Hello, this is Jerry reading the medical news. How COVID and H1N1 swept through United States cities in just weeks. From Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. Public health scientists at the Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health used advanced computer simulations to trace how the 2009 H1N1 flu pandemic and the 2020 COVID-19 pandemic spread across the United States. Their results show how quickly respiratory pandemics can expand and why stopping them early is so challenging. Published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the research is the first to directly compare how these two pandemics moved through the United States metropolitan areas. Both outbreaks had major consequences in the United States. The 2009 H1N1 flu pandemic led to 274,304 hospitalizations. The 2009 H1N1 flu pandemic led to 274,304 hospitalizations and 12,469 deaths. The COVID-19 pandemic has been even more devastating, with 1.2 million confirmed deaths reported. The researchers aimed to understand how these pandemics traveled geographically in order to improve planning for future outbreaks. To do this, they combined detailed information about how each virus spreads with computer models that accounted for air travel, everyday commuting, and the possibility of super spreading events. Their analysis focused on more than 300 metropolitan areas across the United States. The simulations revealed that both pandemics were already circulating widely in most metro areas within just a few weeks. This widespread transmission often occurred before early case detection or government response measures were in place. Although H1N1 and COVID-19 follow different routes between locations, both relied on shared transmission hubs, including major metro areas such as New York and Atlanta. Air travel played a much larger role than commuting in driving this rapid spread. At the same time, unpredictable transmission patterns added significant uncertainty, making it difficult to anticipate where outbreaks would emerge in real time. The rapid and uncertain spread of the 2009 H1N1 flu and the 2020 COVID-19 pandemics underscores the challenges for timely detection and control. Expanding wastewater surveillance coverage coupled with effective infection control could potentially slow the initial spread of future pandemics, says the study's senior author, Sen Pai, PhD Assistant Professor of Environmental Health Sciences at the Columbia Mailman School. Previous research has highlighted the value of wastewater surveillance as an early warning tool. This new study adds further support, showing that expanding wastewater monitoring could play an important role in improving pandemic preparedness and slowing early transmission. In addition to reconstructing the spread of the last two pandemics, the researchers developed a flexible framework that can be used to study the early stages of other outbreaks. While human movement, especially air travel, is a major driver of pandemic spread, the team notes that other factors also influence how outbreaks unfold. These include population demographics, school calendars, winter holidays, and weather patterns. For more than 10 years, Jeffrey Shaman and colleagues, including Sen Pai, have worked to improve methods for tracking and simulating the spread of infectious diseases, such as influenza and COVID-19. Their real-time forecasting tools estimate how quickly outbreaks grow, where they are likely to spread, and when they may peak, helping guide public health decision-making. How obesity and alcohol may be linked to the rise in colorectal cancer deaths in young adults. From Medical News Today. New predictions of cancer deaths in the United Kingdom and the European Union indicate that although overall deaths from the disease are dropping, more young adults are dying from colorectal cancer. At first glance, the research published this weekend in the Annals of Oncology bears some encouraging news about cancer. Scientists predict that total deaths from cancer in the United Kingdom and European Union will drop in 2024 compared to 2018, 6% for men and 4% for women. However, the reality is more somber when looking into specific types of cancer. Deaths from pancreatic cancer, for example, are predicted to rise in the European Union, slightly among both men and women. The rates are expected to dip slightly in the United Kingdom. The scientists say the most worrisome trend is deaths from colorectal cancer in young adults. While overall deaths from colorectal cancer will decline, age-specific deaths tell a different story. In the United Kingdom, colorectal cancer deaths among men aged 25 to 49 are predicted to surge by 26%. Among women in the same age group, that number climbs to nearly 39%. Dr. Cindy Kin, an associate professor of surgery at Stanford Medicine in California, who was not involved in the research, told Medical News Today that the predictions reflect what we as surgeons and doctors treating patients with colorectal cancer are seeing in the United States as well. We have all seen patients with colorectal cancer who are shockingly young, people in their 30s and 40s, and even the occasional one in their 20s. It's a very concerning trend from a public health perspective. Colorectal cancer deaths are also expected to increase among specific populations within the European Union in the 25 to 49 age group. These include Italian men at 1% and women at 2%, Polish men nearly 6%, Spanish men 5%, and German women 7%. This research doesn't directly answer what is driving colorectal cancer deaths among young adults, but it does point to several lifestyle factors that have been shown to be associated with the disease as potential risks. These include obesity, diabetes, not being physically active, diet, and alcohol consumption. Dr. Carlo Lavecchia, a professor of medical statistics and epidemiology at the University del Studio di Milano in Italy and author of the research, told Medical News Today that overweight, obesity, diabetes, and in broader term, the metabolic syndrome are associated with a 50 to 100% excess relative risk of colorectal cancer. Heavy alcohol drinking is also associated with a 20 to 40% excess risk. According to the National Cancer Institute, the dangers of alcohol could potentially increase the risk of colorectal cancer by as much as 50%. Alcohol consumption is also associated with numerous other cancers, including head and neck cancer, esophageal cancer, breast cancer, and liver cancer. In 2023, the World Health Organization issued a statement indicating that there is no safe amount when it comes to alcohol consumption and health. The most recent data has largely debunked the idea that moderate drinking, say 1 to 2 glasses of wine a day, is good for you. In addition, it is more well-known effects on liver that it is carcinogenic, it has a carcinogenic effect on the liver and multiple organs, including the gastrointestinal tract from the mouth to the colon and rectum, pancreas, breast, uterus, and ovaries, said Kin. However, alcohol consumption isn't the only factor listed in the report. Obesity is also named as a major contributing factor. Individuals with obesity are 30% more likely to develop colorectal cancer. Obesity is also associated with at least 13 cancers, in addition to other significant comorbidities such as diabetes, high blood pressure, and cardiovascular disease. Colorectal cancer is one of the deadliest forms of the disease. It is the third most commonly diagnosed cancer and second leading cause of cancer deaths in the United States, behind lung cancer. From 1995 to 2019, the number of colorectal cancer diagnoses in adults under 55 nearly doubled. In response to rising rates of colorectal cancer in young adults, the United States Preventive Services Task Force announced for the first time that it was lowering the recommended age to begin colorectal cancer screening from 50 to 45. Early and accurate screening has been a cornerstone of lowering colorectal cancer-related mortality. In addition to screening, experts say lifestyle changes, including diet and exercise, are also recommended to lower the risk of colorectal cancer. The key message for colorectal cancer is control of overweight and obesity. Early screening and diagnosis can also reduce such excess risk, said LaVecchia. The American Cancer Society recommends 6 steps to decrease colorectal cancer risks. Number 1, get screened for colorectal cancer. Number 2, eat plenty of fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. 3, exercise regularly. 4, lose weight if you have obesity. 5, quit smoking or don't start. And 6, don't drink alcohol. Eat more plants and move your body every day. The more you build your lifestyle around those priorities, the easier it is to sustain. More produce, less meat, less processed foods. Don't ignore symptoms or assume they are benign. Get checked out and advocate for yourself, said Kin. Tiny microbes may secretly rewire the brain before birth, from Michigan State University. Microbes, or microorganisms, are all around us and play an important role in bodily functions. Michigan State University researchers found that microbes can also impact brain development. This work is significant because modern obstetric practices like peripartum antibiotic use and cesarean delivery disturb the microbiome of mothers and newborns. New research from Michigan State University finds that microbes play an important role in shaping early brain development, specifically in a key brain region that controls stress, social behavior, and vital bodily functions. The study, published in Hormones and Behavior, used a mouse model to highlight how natural microbial exposure not only impacts brain structure immediately after birth, but may even begin influencing development while still in the womb. A mouse model was chosen because mice share significant biological and behavioral similarities with humans, and there are no other alternatives to study the role of microbes on brain development. This work is of significance because modern obstetric practices like peripartum antibiotic use and cesarean delivery disrupt maternal microbes. In the United States alone, 40% of women receive antibiotics around childbirth, and 1/3 of all births occur via cesarean section. At birth, a newborn body is colonized by microbes as it travels through the birth canal. Birth also coincides with important developmental events that shape the brain. We wanted to further explore how the arrival of these microbes may affect brain development, said Alexandra Castillo-Ruiz, lead author of the study and assistant professor in the Michigan State University Department of Psychology. The research team focused on a brain region called the paraventricular nucleus of the hypothalamus, the PVN, which plays a central role in regulating stress, blood pressure, water balance, and even social behavior. Their previous work has shown that mice raised without microbes or germ-free mice had more dying neurons in the PVN during early development. The new study set out to determine whether this increased cell death translated to changes in neuron number in the long run, and if any effects could be caused by the arrival of microbes at birth, or if they began in the womb via signals from maternal microbes. To find out, the researchers used a cross-fostering approach. Germ-free newborn mice were placed with mothers that had microbes and compared them to control groups. When the brains of these mice were examined just 3 days after birth, the results were striking. All mice gestated by germ-free mothers had fewer neurons in the PVN, regardless of whether they received microbes after birth. They also found that germ-free adult mice had fewer neurons in the PVN. Our study shows that microbes play an important role in sculpting a brain region that is paramount for body functions and social behavior. In addition, our study indicates that microbial effects start in the womb via signaling from maternal microbes, said Dr. Castillo-Ruiz. Rather than shunning our microbes, we should recognize them as partners in early life development. They are helping build our brains from the very beginning. Mental health interventions may improve inflammatory bowel disease symptoms. This is from Medical News Today, sorry. A new meta-analysis study of studies from New King's College in London reinforces existing knowledge of the brain-gut axis that links mental health to the development and behavior of inflammatory bowel disease. The findings show that improving depression and anxiety symptoms in people with inflammatory bowel disease reduces the severity of the condition by statistically significant amounts. Mental health therapy interventions in particular were most successful at alleviating the inflammation associated with inflammatory bowel disease. Antidepressants and exercise also resulted in improvements, though smaller. Rather than relying on self-reporting of inflammatory bowel disease symptoms, the researchers tracked levels of two biomarkers commonly associated with inflammatory bowel disease inflammation, calprotectin and C-reactive protein. After searching 5 medical databases for relevant studies, the authors of the study analyzed data from 28 random controlled trials involving 1,789 participants. Where biomarker data existed, it was incorporated into the study's analysis. The study is published in eBioMedicine. The new study builds on existing evidence, establishing and confirming the connection between inflammatory bowel disease and mental health. The study's first author, PhD student Natasha Satan, a PhD student at King's College, cited several statistics from a 2021 study. Depression and anxiety are common in people with inflammatory bowel disease. 25% of people with inflammatory bowel disease have clinical levels of depression. 32% have clinical levels of anxiety. These rates rise to 39% and 58% respectively when the disease is active and inflammation levels are higher. If you take a snapshot of inflammatory bowel disease patients at one time period, it seems as though some inflammatory markers are associated with anxiety or depression symptoms. Dr. Tyne Jess of the Center for Molecular Prediction of Inflammatory Bowel Disease told Medical News Today, there are several mechanistic links between mental health and intestinal inflammation, including vagal nerve signaling, systematic inflammatory markers, and the gut microbiome. Dr. Jess was not involved with the present study. Dr. Rudolph Bedford, a gastroenterologist with St. John's Physician Partners in Santa Monica, California, was also not involved in the research and said that poor psychological state can increase pro-inflammatory cytokines. We also see this with gut dysbiosis or bacterial overgrowth, Dr. Bedford told Medical News Today. These things change the signaling of the brain and also of the potential inflammatory cytokines with inflammatory bowel disease. It goes back and forth between the two, he added. Psychological interventions outperformed antidepressants in improving inflammatory bowel disease symptoms. We know that the brain can regulate some of the activity of the immune system and of our gut, so an improvement in mood may be linked to brain activity, which could reduce inflammation, Satan explained. Better mental health is known to strengthen one's immune system, she said, noting that people with inflammatory bowel disease become able to manage their physical health better. For example, more physical exercise, better diet, improved sleep quality, and they are more likely to take prescribed medications. Psychological therapies may equip people with skills. For example, CBT techniques, mindfulness practices, stress management strategies that would empower them to manage their inflammatory disease better, leading to improved health. The researchers of the present study tracked fecal calprotectin and C-reactive protein, two biomarkers of inflammatory bowel disease, to draw their conclusions. Fecal calprotectin and C-reactive protein are used as measures of intestinal and systemic inflammation and hence reflect disease activity in patients with inflammatory bowel disease, Dr. Jess explained. Both biomarkers can help physicians objectively determine whether a person with inflammatory bowel disease is experiencing a flare-up or if they are currently in remission, Seaton said. Bedford added that they are valuable indicators that a patient's treatment for inflammatory bowel disease is or isn't working. If you have a normal calprotectin, then you pretty much know there is no inflammation in the colon. The same thing goes for the C-reactive protein. If it's normal, then you know your treatment is working. This systemic review and meta-analysis shows that psychological interventions which address mood outcomes have a beneficial effect on both intestinal and systemic inflammation, which I think may still come as a surprise to many people, Dr. Jess noted. Dr. Bedford pointed out that not everybody with mood swings, depression, or anxiety develops inflammatory disease. The same thing goes the other way. Not everybody with inflammatory bowel disease has depression or anxiety, he said. Dr. Bedford said in his practice they often refer inflammatory bowel disease patients for psychological counseling. We find that their inflammatory bowel disease improves when their anxiety and their depression improves or is mitigated in some way, he said. Inflammatory bowel disease is often confused with irritable bowel syndrome, but irritable bowel syndrome does not involve inflammation. Inflammatory bowel disease is an inflammatory autoimmune condition whereby debilitating symptoms, pain, fatigue, incontinence, diarrhea, are caused by inflammation in the gastrointestinal tract. Inflammatory bowel disease is the collective name given to three inflammatory bowel conditions. Crohn's disease, which affects any part of the gastrointestinal tract from the mouth all the way to the anus. Ulcerative colitis, which affects any area in the large intestine. And indeterminate colitis inflammatory bowel disease, which contains features of both Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. There is some indication that Crohn's disease is hereditary, since it tends to be experienced by multiple family members and disproportionately strikes the Jewish population. Stem cell grafts and rehabilitation combined boost spinal cord injury results. From the University of California, San Diego. In recent years, researchers have made measurable progress using animal models to promote tissue regeneration in spinal cord injuries through implanted neural stem cells or grafts. Other efforts have shown that intensive physical rehabilitation can improve function after spinal cord injuries by promoting greater or new roles for undamaged or spared cells and neural circuits. In a paper published in the journal JCI Insight, researchers at University of California, San Diego School of Medicine addressed the question of whether rehabilitation can augment functional outcomes when combined with pro-regenerative therapies such as stem cell grafting. Using a rat model, researchers induced a cervical lesion that impaired the animal's ability to grasp with its forelimbs. There were four groups: animals who underwent the lesion alone, animals who received a subsequent grafting of neural stem cells designed to grow and connect with existing nerves, animals who received rehabilitation only, and animals who received both stem cell therapy and rehabilitation. Rehabilitation therapy for some animals began 1 month after initial injury, a time point that approximates when most human patients are admitted to a spinal cord injury rehabilitation center. Rehabilitation consisted of daily activities that rewarded them with food pellets if they performed grasping skills. The researchers found that rehabilitation enhanced regeneration of injured corticospinal axons at the lesion site in rats, and that a combination of rehabilitation and grafting produced significant recovery in forelimb grasping when both treatments occurred 1 month after injury. These new findings indicate that rehabilitation plays a critically important role in amplifying functional recovery when combined with a pro-regenerative therapy such as neural stem cell transplant, said first author Paul Liu, Ph.D., associate adjunct professor of neuroscience at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. Indeed, we found a surprisingly potent benefit of intensive physical rehabilitation when administered as a daily regimen that substantially exceeds what humans are now provided after spinal cord injury. Senior author Mark H. Tusiansky, MD, professor of neurosciences and director of the Translational Neuroscience Institute at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine, and colleagues have long worked to address the complex challenges of repairing spinal cord injuries and restoring function. In 2020, for example, they reported on the observed benefits of neural stem cell grafts in mice, and in 2019 had described 3D printed implantable scaffolding that would promote nerve cell growth. Spinal cord injuries remain a largely unsolved medical challenge. Nearly 18,000 people in the United States suffer spinal cord injuries each year, with another 294,000 persons living with a spinal cord injury, usually involving some degree of permanent paralysis or diminished physical function, such as bladder control or difficulty breathing. There is a great unmet need to improve regenerative therapies after a spinal cord injury, said Tusiansky. We hope that our findings point the way to a new potential combination treatment consisting of neural stem cell grafts plus rehabilitation, a strategy that we hope to move to human clinical trials over the next 2 years. Shingles vaccination linked to lower dementia risk, more evidence suggests. From Medical News Today, over the past few years, there has been a growing research interest in how the shingles vaccine may help protect against other medical conditions than just herpes zoster, more commonly known as shingles. For example, previous studies provide evidence that shingles vaccine may help prevent cardiovascular conditions such as heart disease and stroke. A study published in January 2026 has even found that the shingles vaccine might help slow biological aging. Additionally, there has been a good deal of research focused on the shingles vaccine and its potential role in dementia prevention. Now, a new study published in the journal The Lancet continues to examine a potential correlation between the shingles vaccine and reduced dementia risk. This new study discovered evidence suggesting receiving the shingles vaccine may help reduce or delay dementia diagnosis in older adults. For this study, researchers began their research by analyzing health records from almost 230,000 older adults born between 1930 and 1960 living in Ontario, Canada, and registered with a primary care provider. On September 15, 2016, Ontario launched an immunization program including the live attenuated single-dose herpes zoster vaccine called Zostavax for adults between the ages of 65 and 70. This allowed researchers to create three different study participant groups: participants born before January 1, 1945 and ineligible for the vaccine, participants born in 1945 who were eligible to receive the vaccine from September through December in 2016, and participants born between January 1, 1946 and September 15, 1951, eligible for the vaccine for about 15.5 months. There have been many analyses in electronic health record and medical claims data that have found that receiving a given vaccine is correlated with a reduced risk of dementia in the future. Pascal Geldsetzer, MD, PhD, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Primary Care and Population Health at Stanford University in California, and lead author of this study, told Medical News Today. These studies have all compared those who get vaccinated with those who do not. Our study takes a fundamentally different approach and thus provides a very different level of evidence. In medicine, what you need to prove that an intervention like a medication or vaccine is working is a randomized trial. So what's so special about our study is that we take advantage of a very similar scenario to a randomized trial. At the study's conclusion, researchers found that individuals who had been eligible for a free shingles vaccine were less likely to receive a dementia diagnosis over 5.5 years. Their risk was 2% lower. Scientists also observed that new dementia diagnoses among birth cohorts eligible for the shingles vaccine in Ontario were much less common than in the same birth groups in other Canadian provinces that did not have a shingles vaccine program. For the first time, we now have evidence that likely shows a cause and effect relationship between shingles vaccination and dementia prevention, Geldsetter said. We find these protective effects to be large in size, substantially larger than those of existing pharmacological tools for dementia. Researchers also found that this possible dementia protective effect from the shingles vaccine was more statistically significant in women than men. This could potentially be due to sex differences in the immune response or in the way in which dementia develops, Geldsetzer explained. Women on average have higher antibody responses to vaccination, for example. We also know that both shingles and dementia are more common in women than in men. Medical News Today had the opportunity to speak with Peter Gleibus, MD, Chief of Neurology and Director of the Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology at Marcus Neuroscience Institute. Gleibus, who was not involved in the research, commented that his first reaction was one of cautious optimism. The findings suggest a potential protective effect of the herpes zoster vaccine against dementia, which is both intriguing and promising, he explained. Dementia is a devastating condition with limited treatment options, so any intervention that could prevent or delay its onset is worth exploring further. I would approach these results with caution. The herpes booster vaccine may lower dementia risk by preventing reactivation of the varicella zoster virus, which has been linked to neuroinflammation. Additionally, the vaccine may have a broader immunomodulatory effects, enhancing neuroimmune health and reducing systemic inflammation. For my patients, I would emphasize that while this study is promising, it is not definitive, Gleibus added. I would encourage eligible patients to consider the herpes zoster vaccine, not only for its potential benefits in reducing dementia risk, but also for its proven ability to prevent shingles and its complications, which can be particularly severe in older adults. Medical News Today also spoke with David Cutler, MD, about these research findings. Cutler pointed out that the Zostavax vaccine is no longer used in the United States, where the newer recombinant Shingrix vaccine is now the norm. For that reason, it cannot be assumed that the results will be the same from these very different vaccines. Another factor limiting the applicability of these results to patients here is that these studies looked at people over 80 years old, he continued. Current Center for Disease Control and Prevention recommendation advised that Shingrix be administered at age 50. It is certainly not proven that these apparently favorable results would apply to a younger population. Presently, there are many interventions for preventing cognitive decline, as well as the general aging condition, Cutler detailed. We could be doing a much better job getting our patients to control blood pressure, avoid smoking, get adequate physical exercise, prevent and control diabetes, eat a healthy diet, and maintain ideal body weight, keep cholesterol levels normal, get enough sleep, limit alcohol consumption, treat depression, avoid social isolation, and avoid traumatic brain injury, which have all been shown to yield positive results in cognitive function and measurements of aging, he suggested. It would be a further advance if the Shingrix vaccine could add to this arsenal of dementia and aging protection, Cutler added. It is unknown whether the vaccine itself, the avoidance of shingles, or both, might provide these beneficial results. Artificial intelligence model offers earlier dementia warnings and better brain cancer detection. From Medical News Today. As the brain is one of the most important organs in the body, its wellness plays an important role in living a long, healthy life. For this reason, being able to early detect and possibly prevent brain-related health issues like dementia, brain aging, and brain cancer is extremely important. To help doctors better predict and detect brain health concerns like dementia risk, brain age, and brain tumor mutations. Researchers at Mass General Brigham have developed a new artificial intelligence model that trained on almost 49,000 brain MRI scans. Researchers believe being able to analyze a large amount of data at one time may provide a better ability for doctors to identify, predict, and treat brain diseases. A study on this new artificial intelligence tool was recently published in the journal Nature Neuroscience. The artificial intelligence tool that researchers at Mass General Brigham developed is called Brain Imaging Adaptive Core, Brain IAC. Brain IAC is an artificial intelligence foundation model that is trained on tens of thousands of brain MRI scans to understand how the brain is structured. Benjamin Kahn, MD, faculty member of the Artificial Intelligence in Medicine program at Mass General Brigham and corresponding author of this study, told Medical News Today that using this core baseline knowledge, the tool can be adapted to identify various brain diseases, determine their severity, and predict future risks from these diseases, said Kahn, who is also an associate professor of radiation oncology at Brigham and Women's Hospital, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and Harvard Medical School. There is a vast trove of data within the millions of brain MRIs performed each year in the United States, Kahn continued. Typically, these scans are analyzed by humans for a particular reason, but this only scratches the surface of the story that these scans might tell us about our patients. With artificial intelligence and advanced computational imaging techniques, we are able to unlock much more information from these scans than ever before, which may lead to potent, clinically useful ways to track a variety of acute and chronic conditions, from stroke to cancer to dementia, as well as predict future risks for patients, he added. Through their study, researchers validated brain IAC's performance on almost 49,000 diverse brain MRI scans. This allowed scientists to determine that the artificial intelligence model is capable of analyzing these MRI scans to help identify brain age, predict dementia risk, detect brain tumor variations, and predict brain cancer survival rates. Identification of these problems will inform clinicians and patients what type of treatment or preventive measures should be taken to reduce future risk, ultimately improving quality of life and survival, Kahn explained. For instance, predicting a high risk of dementia would alert the clinician that this patient should start interventions such as physical exercise, cognitive training, and vascular metabolic risk management to reduce this risk as much as possible. Patients with a particular brain tumor mutation identified may be eligible for targeted therapies aimed at that mutation to improve their disease control. Kahn and his team also discovered that brain IAC outperformed other more task-specific artificial intelligence models and was especially productive when limited training data was available. Perhaps the biggest challenge to developing accurate, robust, clinically translatable artificial intelligence models for medical imaging is the lack of large, well-labeled data sets, which often rest in siloed hospital databases and require significant manual effort to organize, Kahn said. With Brain IAC, we show that when you pre-train a model with unlabeled data, which is much easier to find in large quantities, the model can establish a core knowledge from which it needs much less labeled data for a particular task to perform well. This opens the door to MRI-based models that can be trained from much less labeled data. For instance, a clinical team could adapt Brain IAC for use at their own institution with a small data set to predict things like cancer control, dementia, or even tasks not included in our study, like multiple sclerosis progression or intracranial bleed, without needing thousands of labeled scans for training, which are often infeasible to obtain, he added. Khan said that they have already received numerous queries from research on how to adapt brain IAC to various brain MRI applications. We have released brain IAC in its current form, open source for research purposes, so that it is available to any researcher or practitioner, he explained. In the future, we plan to improve upon the model and expand its application to additional brain disease. Medical News Today had the opportunity to speak with Lavan Sivakumar, MD, a board-certified neurosurgeon and director of neurosurgery and chief of staff at Providence Little Company of Mary in Torrance, California, who commented his initial reaction was one of cautious optimism. From my standpoint, what stood out was not just that this model can perform multiple tasks, we've seen that before, but how it was trained. Brain AIC's use of self-supervised learning across 48,965 diverse MRIs addresses a historical criticism of where artificial intelligence is right now. These models can work well in an academic silo, but not applicable to real-world heterogeneous settings. I am still surprised a single foundation model was able to generalize across several tasks like brain aging, dementia risk, tumor biology, and survival, he continued. This is more impressive, particularly in clinical scenarios where the labeled data is limited. The study showed brain AIAC particularly excelled when training data was scarce, 10% availability scenarios. This represents a more realistic approach than developing a different narrow algorithm for each clinical question. Sivakumar said to continue to find new ways of analyzing brain MRI data sets, as there is a significant amount of information from brain MRIs that are not currently extracted in regular clinical practice. Clinicians are trained and quite facile at pattern recognition, but qualitative interpretation remains challenging, he continued. Like this can identify some early patterns of atrophy or microstructural changes seen in tumors that are either not visible to the human eye or we don't have standardized reports for. For disease states like dementia and brain cancer, where earlier risk stratification or more accurate prognostication can have tremendous impacts on counseling, surveillance, and treatment planning, these insights matter tremendously. Additionally, the ability to analyze MRIs across institutions and across imaging platforms is critical if these tools are going to be able to be adopted in real clinical practice. Medical News Today also spoke with Lana Savirdas Ryerson, MD, Director of Neuroimmunology Division at the Jersey Shore University Medical Center, about this new research. Ryerson commented that she was very impressed with the breadth of abilities of this artificial intelligence model across so many different functions of neuroradiology. It is important to continue to find new ways of analyzing brain MRI data sets, because we do not have reliable and easy-to-use resources to do these things in clinical practice, she explained. Across the neurology field, we recognize that it is important to recognize disease processes early, as it gives us the best chance to treat effectively and prevent worsening. Yet, too often, we see delays in diagnosis due to lack of biomarkers and inconsistent recognition of risk factors or red flags among patients. I would like to see this artificial intelligence model evaluated in clinical practice, Ryerson added. Blocked blood flow makes cancer grow faster, from NYU Langone Health. Cutting off blood flow can prematurely age the bone marrow, weakening the immune system's ability to fight cancer, according to a new study from New York University Langone Health. Published online in JACC Cardio-Oncology, the study showed that peripheral ischemia-restricted blood flow in the arteries in the legs caused breast tumors in mice to grow at double the rate seen in mice without restricted flow. These findings build on a 2020 study from the same team that found ischemia during a heart attack to have the same effect. Ischemia occurs when fatty deposits such as cholesterol accumulate in artery walls, leading to inflammation and clotting that restrict the flow of oxygen-rich blood. When this happens in the legs, it causes peripheral artery disease, which affects millions of Americans and can increase the risk of a heart attack or stroke. Our study shows that impaired blood flow drives cancer growth, regardless of where it happens in the body, says corresponding author Catherine J. Moore, Ph.D., the Jean and David Bleckman Professor of Cardiology in the Department of Medicine, NYU Grossman School of Medicine. This link between peripheral artery disease and breast cancer growth underscores the critical importance of addressing metabolic and vascular risk factors as part of a comprehensive cancer treatment strategy. Importantly, the research team found that restricted blood flow triggers a shift toward immune cell populations that cannot efficiently fight infections and cancer, mirroring changes we see with aging. To examine the mechanisms behind the link between cardiovascular disease and cancer growth, the study authors developed a mouse model with breast tumors and induced temporary ischemia in one hind limb. The team then compared cancer growth in mice with and without impaired blood flow. Their findings build on the nature of the immune system, which evolved to attack invading bacteria and viruses, and under normal conditions, to detect and eliminate cancer cells. These protective functions rely on stem cell reserves in the bone marrow, which can be activated as needed to produce key white blood cell populations throughout life. Normally, the immune system responds to injury or infection by ramping up inflammation to eliminate threats, then scaling back to avoid harm to healthy tissue. This balance is maintained by a mix of immune cells that either activate or suppress inflammation. The researchers found that reduced blood flow disrupts this equilibrium. It reprograms stem cells in the bone marrow to favor the production of myeloid immune cells, that is, monocytes, macrophages, neutrophils, that dampen immune cells and immune responses, while reducing output of lymphocytes, like T cells, that help to mount strong anti-tumor responses. The local environment within tumors showed a similar shift, accumulating more immune-suppressive cells, including LY6 Chi monocytes, M2-like F4 80 plus MHC 111O microphages, and regulatory T cells that shield cancer from immune attack. Further experiments showed that these immune changes were long-lasting. Ischemia not only altered the expression of hundreds of genes, shifting immune cells into a more cancer-tolerant state, but also recognized the structure of chromatin, the protein scaffolding that controls access to DNA, making it harder for immune cells to activate genes involved in fighting cancer. Our results reveal a direct mechanism by which ischemia drives cancer growth, reprogramming stem cells in ways that resemble aging and promote immune tolerance, says first author Alexandra Newman, Ph.D., a postdoctoral scholar in Dr. Moore's lab. These findings opened the door to new strategies in cancer prevention and treatment, like earlier cancer screening for patients with peripheral artery disease and using inflammation modulating therapies to counter these effects. Moving forward, the research team hopes to help design clinical studies that evaluate whether existing inflammation-targeted therapies can counter post-ischemic changes driving tumor growth. Depression may be the brain's early warning signs of Parkinson's or dementia. From Shanghai University. While there is currently no cure for Parkinson's disease or Lewy body dementia, addressing depression early could improve quality of life and overall care for patients as these diseases develop. A study published in General Psychiatry provides the most detailed longitudinal evidence to date, demonstrating that depression frequently precedes the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease and Lewy body disease and remains elevated for several years thereafter. Drawing on a comprehensive Danish National Health Registrars, the researchers conducted a retrospective case-controlled study, including 17,711 individuals diagnosed with either disease between 2007 and 2019. Researchers compared these patients with people of similar age and sex who were diagnosed with other long-term conditions, including rheumatoid arthritis, chronic kidney disease, and osteoporosis. The results showed a clear pattern. Depression occurred more often and earlier in people who went on to develop Parkinson's disease or Lewy body dementia than in those with other chronic illnesses. In the years leading up to the diagnosis, the risk of depression rose steadily, peaking in the 3 years before diagnosis. Even after diagnosis, patients with Parkinson's disease or Lewy body dementia continued to experience higher rates of depression than the comparison group. This pattern could not be fully explained by the emotional burden of living with a chronic illness. Other long-term diseases that also involve disability did not show the same strong increase in depression risk. And this suggests that depression may be linked to early neurodegenerative changes in the brain rather than being only a psychological reaction to declining health. These findings were especially striking for Lewy body dementia, where the rates of depression were even higher than Parkinson's disease, both before and after diagnosis. Researchers note that differences in disease progression and brain chemistry may help explain this trend. The authors emphasize that this does not mean everyone with depression will develop Parkinson's disease or dementia. Instead, they recommend greater awareness and closer monitoring when depression appears for the first time in older adults. While there is currently no cure for Parkinson's disease or Lewy body dementia, addressing depression early could help improve quality of life and overall care for patients as these diseases develop.